Like, it's kind of the impetus of selecting a text that you wrote, Grant, was that when I first got back to Beijing, I was talking with Elaine and then Fotini, who's another founder, collaborator at Home Shop, and they said, "We've just started reading Grant Custer. Why has it been so long? We haven't ever read him before. We've been missing it." And I said, "Oh, I work with Grant. We should read him for reading group." And it's just taken some time for us to actually organize the meeting. And then I thought it would be awesome if you could come and talk to us as well. And then I picked the Efflux Breaking Glass text because I thought it was interesting, and also because it's not super long. And it also, it's not a section of a book, which would be just kind of shortening a larger project.
Yeah, it's kind of self-contained.
Yes.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Wait, when was it written? It's recent, right?
It's really recent. It's one of your most recent texts, yes?
Yeah, there's a... I wrote it a little while ago, but it's fairly recent. Definitely. It's one of the more recent ones. Yeah, I've got another one that just came out in Art Journal, but I think that just came out like 2 weeks ago. I can send a copy of it to you guys if you want.
Yeah, that would be fantastic.
Yeah. Be happy to. I'll make a note.
I don't... Maybe one question to start with would be, how do you see the Breaking Glass text in relation to the rest of the writing that you've done?
It came out of a conversation I had when I was at the University of Pittsburgh. I went out there because I'm on a student's PhD committee that's at Pittsburgh, and I was having this conversation. I'd given a talk that was on Santiago Sierra, and somehow or the other I got this conversation with Terry Smith, who teaches out there, and kept mentioning Lenin, but you're not acknowledging Lenin's arguments or something, and I'm not quite sure how it will relate, but that's a little fuzzy now. And then I thought, well, I really want to go back and look at Lenin, you know, because Lenin's kind of gotten in vogue recently, Zizek and so on, been writing about him. And I already had some intuitions about what I thought were the relationships between vanguard politics and avant-garde art movements. Like, I had a kind of a intuition of how those things are connected in the 19th century, and so I thought I'd like to drill down a little bit into some of the literature around the Russian Revolution and see what some of the more fundamental relationships are between those two discourses or those two systems of kind of thought and action. And so that, so I took the essay as an opportunity to do that, and then also that, Graciela Carnevale piece has been in vogue a lot also, you know, kind of got resuscitated by a number of people recently as a model for, antagonistic performance or something like that. And so I thought that'd be a good test case, you know, to look at. And Oriana, as you know, I've worked with, you know, Fabian, who's one of our PhD students, who's from Argentina, and, you know, his parents were there at the time, and he was before they moved to Mexico. So I had a little bit of a familiarity from Fabian about the politics in Argentina at the time. So all of that stuff came together, and I decided to write about Lenin and write about the Carnevale piece as in terms of how they're connected and what they reveal about the way artists think about how to relate to people, I suppose. And to give a little more depth to that argument, you know, like a little more historical depth to the argument than I was able to give in the last book I did.
Awesome. Questions? Anyone? Well, I guess I don't. I think that what's really interesting for us, or at least thinking through the relation of the article to us a little bit here at Home Shop, is that we've been, I think, one of the themes that keeps coming back in a lot of the reading groups that we've been having, and then also in kind of a lot of the different practices that have been happening at Home Shop and with a lot of the people that are affiliated with Home Shop, are issues of activism and the political and social engagement.
Mm-hmm.
Elaine, maybe you could expand a little bit.
I'm not very prepared today. I don't know. I think, well, with this idea that that the sort of politicization of art is always amplified in the case of opportunities of repression. I mean, I think I was thinking about that in regards to when you mentioned a lot about that in regards to the Argentinian group. And
yeah.
I think everyone who comes here, or artists who are thinking about China, tend always to make everything political. And I think, of course, it's easy to read everything in that way, especially under terms of tension between the subject and the state. But somehow, like, it goes very far away from that, I feel, in the actual process of how artists are working on a daily level here. That could be a particular Chinese reaction to then, or deliberately sort of leave politics and ignore it almost. That doesn't mean that it's not politicized, but it's somehow, I don't know, what do you think, Xiao? Like that it's deliberately sort of effaced.
That's being ignored exactly?
The sort of politics and the relation to the state, because maybe it's so sort of strained in a certain sense. I think that the way of dealing with it on a daily level is almost to efface it, you know, or make a joke of it. Like especially now, I think with the party congress. It's obviously that those kind of strains are sort of filtered out everywhere, and that there's certain repressions that are kind of reaching out on a broad-based level to everyone here. But the way to deal with it then becomes a sort of like make lots of jokes about it and turn it into something kind of light. And because you're not allowed to really deal with it, address it directly, even in terms of artwork. I mean, whether or not art is direct is another question, but I think it seems almost that there's an opposite sort of move, I would say.
I would agree with you in the sense that we don't really see so much of directly addressing political issues.
Yeah.
But art production becomes very diversified. Somehow they indirectly relate back to it. You trace, you know, different messages are embedded in different artworks. But there's not really a direct discussion or direct confrontation with political issues. And for me, maybe this is a matter of accessibility in the sense that different layers of truth, different layers of information get distributed in a different way, so people, especially artists, I don't think they really feel empowered to even know what's going on, let alone to address what's going on. And then it comes the heavy censorship and police state security. I mean, that would be the external factor.
Mm-hmm.
But I say the internal factor, it would be the very disempowerment in relation to truth.
So what I'm questioning then is what is that transition between this so-called disempowerment of maybe the artist,
yeah,
but then as a critic or a theory or a historian reading into this work and being able to see that political facet of all of this,
mm-hmm,
then you sort of bring the politics back to the forefront.
I would say, yeah.
So there's that. It's a really, for me, that's a really interesting transition between the making of the artwork,
yeah,
and then later how it's sort of reanalyzed on a theoretical level, and I don't know if Grant has any sort. I mean, I actually haven't read so much of your previous work, so I don't know so much about dialogical aesthetics. But I just wonder if that sort of that dialogue is something that then is always something that happens after the fact. You know, it's not because I don't know, the political nature may not be so present.
Well, yeah, I mean, every situation's different, isn't it? And I'm not familiar with what you guys have to deal with there. I mean, just secondhand, right? We kind of have a sense that the level of censorship and state control is pretty profound. It's even hard for journalists in China to report on things that are only tangentially related to political because they could reflect on the party. So that really narrows your options. You know, in Argentina, they have a situation where a previously relatively free country was taken over by a military dictatorship. So at that moment, before the country was completely overrun by the military dictatorship, there was a kind of an open space existence, but then that was quickly crushed. Whereas your situation is dealing, it seems like it's dealing with a fairly rigidified system of control that's been in power for a long, long time, and it's hard for everybody to see outside it, you know, to see that there's other possibilities of resistance without ending up arrested or something. So every situation requires different tactics, I suppose. Like in the last book I wrote, there's a discussion of some work by a group that worked for about 8 years in Myanmar before the recent thaw. And it was a Singapore-based artist, two Singapore-based artists, and what they did there took a long time, and it was really not very dramatic and didn't involve, you know, lots of visible acts of resistance against the military regime in Myanmar, because if they had done that, they either would have been put in jail or kicked out of the country. So they set up a series of artist workshops. And in Myanmar, the biggest problem is that all the arts groups there don't trust each other because there's so many police spies, or there were so many police spies. And so there was no tradition of people actually trusting each other outside of a very small circle of friends or family or people that were interrelated. And everybody else, they would put on this different face. And the different face was to, you know, say the things that you're supposed to say in case the person you're talking to is going to report you. And so it took them, it was Jay Ko and Chu Yan, were two artists. It took them years, but they eventually set up a series of these artist spaces and workshops in which these groups that had previously been kind of at odds with each other began to work together. And one of the byproducts of it was that a number of the younger artists actually set up their own spaces. And those spaces have emerged now in the fall in Myanmar is kind of nodal points for cultural activism in the country to some extent, you know. So that was 6 or 7 years of laying the groundwork, a kind of a prefiguration, so to speak, of what it would look like, right, for people to be able to get along and have conversations and dialogues and reach consensus about difficult issues in a context in which there was no real training or preparation for that at all. So that's one kind of practice that's really different, you know, than the kind of practice you'd see in another context, or that what would make sense in China, I would think. You probably in different parts of China, Shanghai versus Beijing versus who knows where else. So I think one of the things that I try to stress is the situational nature of resistance, and in particular this kind of art practice, that it's very problematic to extrapolate from a small number of cases, axioms that should govern how all art should be understood as quote-unquote activist or resistant or anything else. And you really have to look closely at the history and the context of each moment in each space, because power operates in different ways, in different settings. And there is no, you know, not everything has to look like May 68 or the storming of the Winter Palace to be political, right?
Yeah, I think but what you said about the rigidity of the government repression and limiting modes of expression, I always thought it was more to do with...
Well, you guys are just coming out a little bit. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, we can hear you, but maybe you can't hear us.
But yeah, I thought the
last 30 seconds or so, I think.
Just what you said earlier about the idea that this sort of rigidity of repression limiting modes of expression in China, I had always kind of thought that in recent years, this effacement that you talk about in terms of political work and the absence of it is more to do with a relaxation of that repression in terms of paralyzing modes of expression. Because when you have a sort of fixed repressive system that can be reacted against, there's a mode for expression. With the recent sort of acceptance of various cultural forms, like the government sanctioned art zones, you know, there's an acceptance. And so it makes me think of, you know, the Raymond Williams essay, The Dominant Residual Emergent, in terms of parts of culture being absorbed into the dominant system. And so that's kind of paralyzing the artists, because they have, you know, when things are accepted so easily and they become brought within the framework of the mainstream, then that
that's what's paralyzing, and that's what breeds this effaced mode of doing things and this passive stance. But I don't know.
It's kind of like happened in Russia, right, during the Perestroika period, where all the samizdat artists that were underground and couldn't kind of put their heads up all of a sudden are getting invited to New York and showing galleries and so on. It confuses the hell out of people.
Yeah.
The regime starts to become more accommodating, I guess. So is that that's what you guys feel is going on now in China to some extent?
Well, I would say maybe that happened in China more profoundly in the early 90s, because after 89, there was a huge crackdown, and so almost all public exhibitions were banned. And at that time, it was also when Chinese artists were really gaining cultural capital within the emergent biennial structure. And so they were increasingly shown abroad and selling abroad and making lots and lots of money and bringing it back to China. And so I think the government had to really significantly rethink their relationship to like avant-garde art in China in the early 90s.
Yeah, with the marketization, obviously, is like a big factor as well. That's kind of something separate from the government system.
I would say that it's not that... I don't really want to say it's effacement that's the problem of political messages. It's more like the very gesture of being political, the strength of a politically, you know, subversive message has waned. This will be my impression, is that you cannot really, really put out a truly politically subversive message anymore. I think this is the shift.
But is that because you're saying that the artists don't have any knowledge of power? Like they're so disempowered because they don't have any detailed knowledge?
I would say it's
because there's no avenue, no venue for it.
Because, okay, so if you actually look at in terms of history in the earlier phases, I think what happens is like you have a rather, that's what Elaine... Bella was saying that you have a rather more rigid system of repression, at which point any little thing can be considered subversive, like abstract painting, you know, that's considered subversive. So it's very simplistic structure at the time. But as people caught on, as the world become more complex, the same message, the same thing you were saying before that were considered political or subversive, they cease to be that. So you also have to evolve along with finding what is truly political or what is truly subversive to the system, because the system has evolved and became much more complex and you are ahead of the game in this sense. So
if you think that subversiveness is no longer possible, do you think it's still important for the artist to address it in their work? Like
yes
to
and
try
no. Yes and no.
To be subversive.
I would say yes and
to
no.
Address
yeah.
The systems of power.
I would say yes in the sense that you still kind of have to think, okay, what is my task? What has to be done here? So I would say yes. But no in the sense you cannot resort to pre-established means or pre-established ways of communicating your message. So precisely, it's almost a cause for a more in-depth analysis of what the present situation is in order to make work respond accordingly in accordance with that.
That's the thing, there's no correspondence. It's all diffuse. I mean, in the same, I don't know about the essay that you mentioned, but this idea of that emergent or the effective between that is this sort of diffuseness and everything kind of gets pithered out amidst all of this, I don't know, this, what you see now is this completely complex systems of power locked with the economy and such and such.
Yeah.
So that sort of, maybe you almost distractment on the part of the artist is also on the part of the viewer. And I don't know that.
I would agree, but only in the sense that you could consider them different modes of participation.
Of participation.
And
yeah.
These modes are interconnected to form the network. So
yes.
Technically, by theory, by subverting or by changing just one mode, you change the whole thing.
Yes, possibly. You're very optimistic, Sal.
But I wonder if here, okay, the text isn't about here, but I wonder here if actually there's a real desire to do subvertive work. You know, if there's a desire among artists as a collective, as a group, and as...
I think only I will.
Well, yeah, but his actual political work is not in art. You know, his subvertive work is not in art, you know. His, I don't think there's an appetite from a gallery-going public, unless it's a foreign public, and there's not an appetite in society in general for subvertive works. I mean, and the artists that are subvertive are normally the really cynical ones here that say, oh, it's fucked. Mm-hmm. And you ask them, okay, what next? Oh, it's fucked. And so, and you've made your money telling the West it's fucked. That's that's fine. Good for you.
Can you give an example?
Birdhead.
Who? Birdhead?
Yeah.
I don't know him.
Oh, two photographers out of Shopper.
I think subversiveness can like work on a lot of levels, and it's what you think is political, because when we're saying that the government system is so complex and works on so many levels, you know, the personal becomes political, and so you can make work that's subversive on like a small scale.
That's what exactly I agree completely, in the sense that there's no big subversive. You have to first of all analyze and realize the complexity that is inherent to this notion of being subversive.
And I think, yeah, the oblique strategies for dealing with political issues are now far more effective than direct strategies.
Right.
Is it interesting to think through a little bit? One of the things that came up a lot in the text, I thought, Grant, was your discussion about reception and the viewer as a surrogate for the artist. And so maybe we could talk a little bit about that and then think, too, about the role of the viewer, participant, audience in possible acts of resistance in relation to, I guess, maybe other art practices outside of China and then art practices inside of China.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I was just enjoying listening to the conversation. I had a question, I suppose, which is just from my ignorance of the situation there. Like a lot of the projects that I've looked at over the years, artists are working in conjunction with, they're not just kind of abstractly on their own fomenting subversive art. They're usually working in some alliance or affiliation with other groups and often organized groups. They're protesting or contesting power in some way. So there's forms of alliance and solidarity. Are there models of that in China? I mean, is that an even possibility that there could be, let's say, a group that organizes around evictions, or a group that organizes around government incompetence in the construction of the railroads, or is that just simply not allowed, and so it's not even a possibility for artists to align themselves or form solidarities with groups that are resisting in other contexts?
I know other people might know, but the only semi-cause that I know in Beijing that people have organized around was about them being the artists themselves being evicted from their studios. It was a very self-centered
and
cause.
Very immediate and short term.
Very immediate, very short term. Yeah. Went away very quickly and ended very ugly with a lot of infighting.
I would say, since the sort of fall of the Chinese art market, I would say you see more kind of solidarity, but not necessarily aligned along directly political issues. There are more sort of art groups, small collectives, this kind of thing's happening. And then the more directly activist groups, I would say they're not connected necessarily to art or to the art world, I would say. Because that's the thing, I think it's very there's a big polarity here in the art world as an economic system and an engine versus just some people that may be making art, but it's a very divided community.
That makes sense.
And I guess the older artists that were maybe subversive, whenever there has been, for example, when the protests were here, they were very much on the fringe, not because they wanted to be on the fringe, but because they couldn't go and be there without, you know, getting in a lot of trouble.
Mm.
But that, maybe they didn't want to be there either, who knows.
Is it because the strength of the art market, and especially the expansion of auction houses and galleries that are catering to the contemporary art market in China, is it very much seen for some Chinese artists as a kind of a career path to become an artist and hope to make money selling? Like, that's kind of seems a pathway to success somehow, is that right?
Yeah, it's really recognized, I think a lot of the students that are studying at the Art Academy now, I mean, it's a career path like being an accountant, you know?
Yes. Yeah, no, I've heard that it's a fallback for, like, if you don't get into a good school to become a doctor or a lawyer, that being an artist is a highly regarded fallback.
Wow.
I heard it at Kappa. I was there for a year.
Yeah.
In the dorm.
No, it's true.
Yeah, that's really so different than in this country.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of money, and I don't know, Chinese artists, I think, were some of the first, like, really auspicious spenders in the early 90s.
Oh, yeah?
Right?
Spenders?
Spenders. Like, they were driving black Audis and opening restaurants, and so...
Yeah, but there was a lot of other people driving black Audis. I mean, the samples, you know, like, you know... There are a lot of people getting rich.
Yes.
There was a lot,
I mean, among the people who did get rich,
they were artists spending.
were not so much expected than the artist would.
But there has been, like, a significant divergence of artists working in solidarity with other political groups, because after the Cultural Revolution, the first artist groups were working alongside, like, Today Magazine and the Democracy Wall, and then also too protesting in the streets directly after the Star Show was canceled.
That's what I'm saying, though, that the system has become more complex. Back then, these kind of possibilities are possible.
Right.
Not so much today. No, as possible.
Yeah, I would imagine if you know, becoming an artist and getting an MFA could be seen as something that would lead you to being able to buy a black Audi, then the incentive for young artists to choose deliberately to provoke the state and risk imprisonment or retaliation is pretty low, as opposed to the incentive to simply do what the market expects you to do, right? I mean, is there a yearning among a lot of artists to challenge authority, or not? It seems like there wouldn't be much of an incentive to do it.
No, I mean, the money career path thing is one thing. I don't think that's the big issue, though. You know, in the West, I mean, sort of, as your article demonstrates, when you're the political activist, you're sort of heroic. You know, the artist, or not just the artist, but anyone, and that doesn't exist here. There's not that culture. And then I think what Xiao said before as well. A lot of people here generally, and then the artists, are just disempowered because they don't have knowledge of what power is. My example would be the art students that come from Hangzhou Academy and then just hang out in a village at the edge of Beijing and try and be part of the Beijing art world. They have no idea of what's happening in this city.
Actually, in relation to your writing, Grant, that I got this sense that this kind of this heroic... like struggling individual against normative powers of society, you are of the opinion that it's a bygone kind of thing. They say you belong to the modernist narrative to have this kind of persona or identity for the artist. Whereas in the contemporary art, you will have something different, right? Perhaps collaborative, participatory, this kind of thing. Could you say more about that?
Sorry, can you rephrase it? Broke up a little bit.
Okay, let me break it up a little bit.
Yeah. So
basically, in relation to modern art, the identity of the artist is like this struggling individual, heroic figure, the subject against society or other normative systems, right? But I get the impression that you do not see that being the case in relation to contemporary art, in the sense that
I see what you're saying.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I think. Well, I certainly think it's still necessary for artists in many cases. At least, the first thing we have to acknowledge is that there at this point there are so many different art worlds, right? I mean, it's the art world, the globalization of the market for contemporary art has created a situation in which there are multiple registers of art production, multiple circuits of legitimation for art compared to, say, 40 or 50 years ago. It's phenomenal. So you really have to be aware of what art world, what subculture you're talking about. There certainly is the subculture of biennials and famous curators, of a class of artists who are able to circulate globally, kind of cosmopolitan artists that are given commissions and develop temporary projects and biennials and so on, and they're the ones that are really the most visible, right? And they certainly do. I mean, that you could argue that in the case of figures like Santiago Sierra or Thomas Hirschhorn or Francis Elise, they very, very much present themselves as these kind of nomadic agents of critique who are challenging the dominant power and so on. I mean, that's often very self-consciously stage what they do, even as they're being awarded commissions and winning prizes left, right, and center. So I think that mythos still persists, and it's necessary because that's part of what we buy when we buy contemporary art. We're buying the personality of the artist as a kind of a transgressive rebel. That's been the case for, the better part of the 20th century, is that you're really consuming the subject position as much as the product. But I also do think that there's, and again, this is my experience with projects, in Europe, Africa, a little bit in Southeast Asia, not in China at all, so I'm not familiar with the situation there, and Eastern Europe. And you do have a lot of artists, I think, who have, especially, I feel, with the kind of dramatic expansion and monetization of contemporary art that's happened in the last 15 years, really getting disillusioned with that world, that particular circuit. And and that's kind of coincided globally with, in the last 5 to 7 years, increasing levels of organized resistance to political regimes in a lot of different contexts. Certainly have the Arab Spring. There are certain groups that were emerged prior to or out of the Arab Spring. In Latin America, this goes back to the Pink Tide of the 1990s, but you've got a number of fairly active groups working throughout Latin America that very much see what they do as antithetical to the biennial circuit of blue chip artists, doing relational practices and so on. So that's another circuit of people. And I'd say at that circuit, some of the norms of authorial sovereignty and the personality, kind of personality cult of the artist, you do see these things being questioned a little bit. You see, in particular, I think, a kind of an attentiveness to the construction of the artistic personality itself. Mm-hmm. As part of one's practice, that is, that what you thematize is the idea of artistic creation itself, rather than that being the naturalized condition of what one does in the world. And so I do come across this a lot, with younger artists that are not part of the biennial circuit, a stepping back from this heroic thing that you're describing a little bit, even as it persists in a lot of other places.
But I was trying to work out, in the text, are you advocating for this heroic, exemplary violence against the normative state, or are you saying that's okay? Spontaneity? That's kind of stupid, unlike with Lenin here, or that's what I was. I think that's what you're trying to get at. Is that?
Well, I'm just trying to.
Yeah, no, I'm not saying spontaneity is stupid. That's really good. Spontaneity is not stupid. No, I think,
or disruptive.
The other stuff I've done. But by way of context, a lot of the practices that I've looked at in my research have probably come, would fall more on the Voline spontaneity side of the equation than the provocation and attack. In fact, I've been widely criticized precisely because I've been critical of that notion of the heroic artist assaulting the viewer kind of a thing. So, I'm not saying, it maybe doesn't come out in the article very clearly, but I am interested in practices that are willing to be critical of the construction of the artistic personality in certain ways. Absolutely, I find that I find it interesting. I find it part of what artists are doing today. And so, you know, you have to look at what artists actually do. A lot of art historians, they're critics. They kind of see what artists do, and then they decide they don't like it, but they don't write about it. But you know, it's what artists do. One is obliged to try to learn about and learn from. So I've kind of taken that as my approach, and that's what I see thematically, I suppose, among a lot of groups is the less heroic approach. So I would say, yeah, I'm probably that's what I've written more about for sure. This is a long-winded way to answer your question. Sorry about that.
Okay.
Are you still there?
Yeah, we're there.
Sorry, I thought I cut off for a second.
Pause.
What really interested me, as well as you're talking about the model of the artist and the artist's personality, but also the model of the gallery, when you're talking about the breaking of the glass and the, you know, the sort of literalization of the gallery barrier between the viewer and the outside world. And that kind of interests me because I think if we're thinking about the irrelevance of certain artists' models, there's also an irrelevance of certain gallery models in terms of showing art. And there's a sort of draining of relevance from all art that is shown in this way, because when people go to the gallery, they don't expect to see something that is relevant to their lives immediately, and it's become sort of esoteric territory.
Sorry, it broke up a little bit. I heard gallery-based model. Can you explain that again?
Yeah, well, because we're talking now about the irrelevance of certain models for the artists themselves, but I was quite interested in when you talk about the literal barrier of the gallery space with the glass between the viewer and the outside world, and thinking about the irrelevance of actual gallery systems in terms as they stand, commercial gallery systems in terms of showing art and people, the viewer, how relevant they find the art to actual real lived reality.
Right. How relevant galleries are, yeah. Mm. I mean, I'm probably not the ideal person to answer that question because very little of what I write about is shown in galleries. So I know about galleries kind of just as a interest of, you know, art historian or whatever. But so take that, you know, my observations with a grain of salt, but it does seem like there's been, you know, if you accept the idea that there's been a little bit of a shift in the nature of contemporary art practice towards performative, relational approaches to art making, that's one of the most decisive shifts. Not that there aren't still lots of people cranking out sculpture and painting, that work's being bought and sold, but that in terms of the newer practices, you know, you can say that the figures that tend to dominate at this particular moment tend to be relational approaches, if you think of Boreau's work and the kind of people he writes about, and that work has been taken up by not just biennials, but major museums like the Tate Modern, the Guggenheim, and the Modern. And at this point in the U.S., at least, you've got a lot of museums trying to get on the bandwagon of some kind of participatory art practice. I was just last year was asked to talk to some curators at the Museum of Contemporary Art in LA about how they might implement a program of commissioned participatory practices. And I always found this kind of odd, because I feel like museums do and galleries do a great job of showing objects, and I'd love to see paint, you know, I'd like to see art objects. That doesn't mean I don't like them because I write about other things, but I think museums and galleries feel like their relevance is being called into question because of the movement away from certain object-based practices, and the fact that a lot of the money is being, and kind of art historical legitimacy is being directed to less object-based practices. So first you have the problem of how to monetize ephemeral work. You know, that's the challenge that somebody like Santiago Sierra or Francis Alise or Pierre Huche or Perino or any of those people face. And that's happened in part, I suppose, because of the biennial model, which involves, you know, nation states sinking money into commissions. And if you look at the way a lot of that work's funded, usually you look at the show thing, the announcement, and down at the bottom there'll be all these little icons, these little logos for the different cultural fund foundations in the EU, for example, that funded it. So really, that's not a market model, that's a state model. That's probably like a state funding model. And then the market gets involved, I suppose, because the artists get a certain level of credibility and circulation. And then the gallery comes along and they have to figure out what product that person can produce that can be sold in the gallery to a collector or a dealer. And that's where you get the drawings and the sketches and the schematics and the models and the maquettes and the photographs and documentation going into the market system. So it is complicated, and it puts galleries in a complicated situation if they don't want to look too retrograde. They have to kind of jump on the bandwagon, but at the same time, it's hard to figure out how to generate capital out of this kind of work. I mean, I think it'll shift. You know, the art world goes through these cycles periodically, and I think it's going to get bored with the idea of activist or relational practice, and then it'll, you know, they're building up a great hunger of buyers that want to get back to the beauty of painting. It'll be like neo-expressionism in the 80s, where everybody got sick of arid conceptualism and they wanted oil on a canvas again. So it'll probably happen. I don't know if it'll happen. I kind of, the cynical side of me thinks that's going to happen again. So I don't know. Beyond that, the relevance of galleries, they're probably very relevant in certain contexts. It's just I have so little experience myself writing about work, about artists whose work ends up in them, that I'm not really in a good position to defend them.
I guess I meant more like how these systems of display reduce the relevance of the actual artwork rather than the relevance of these systems, because in the end that's what's the thing that is important, is the artwork itself. And so if the systems become irrelevant, then they then affect the artwork that's being displayed in the way the viewer perceives it. And so, you know, maybe we need to think of new ways that art can be shown in a more grassroots level, perhaps.
But you're talking about, for example, he gives all these examples of the documentation, the sketches, whatever, that assist this sort of processual kind of ephemeral artwork. Mm-hmm. And you're asking if that sort of takes away or from the artwork itself, or what do you mean? Because of its need to be in the gallery?
I think it's more about like the actual space of the gallery or the museum, and how like pre-established like narratives of these spaces, mm-hmm. and so how we understand them when we go to them, like molds the way we absorb whatever is within them, and this might be a sort of paralyzing factor in terms of how we understand the artwork, because it's always framed in the same way, mm-hmm. in this space, and this space is becoming increasingly irrelevant to people's lives and what they expect from the artwork, and also the works being put in themselves.
So, if I understand you correctly, you're saying basically, rather than do institutional critique, focus on social critique. Something like that. To basically do away with mediation. Is kind of what
It's an issue with the mediation.
Yeah. I mean, Greg, would you, what is your opinion on this line of thinking? In the sense that to do away with mediation and to bypass it and not bother with institutional critique anymore, but directly engaging society. I mean, what do you...
Yeah, I wouldn't say you're bypassing mediation. There's always mediation, and there's always institutions. You know, it's just mindfully choosing the institutions you work with, or at least being aware of the mediation to begin with. You know, I would probably be cautious about some idea that, you know, by working outside of institutional critique, you're getting into a more direct proximity to the real or something. It's just the different institutions that come into play in different discursive systems. But I do think that, I suppose, if you were a proponent of institutional critique, at least in the U.S., you could say that at this point, institutional critique has been pretty well assimilated by the institutions it was meant to critique in the first place.
Yep.
You know, and that's okay. You know, in a way, that's kind of what art history does. You've got an innovation that pushes against the norms, and then it gets assimilated. You know, it eventually gets either ignored or assimilated into the conventions, and then you move forward. So that's not entirely surprising. But I guess you could say maybe it. And somebody said this earlier that, you know, you have to adjust your practice for the moment you live in, and maybe we don't need people like, you know, doing Daniel Buren installations or, you know, Fred Wilson installations anymore. That's kind of, institutions have figured out how to be responsive to these things, and maybe in that responsiveness, maybe the victory's already been won. As soon as you have institutions getting all, you know, self-reflective about their archives and self-reflective about how they construct their notion of the public and what their docents do, then Andrea Fraser's, you know, accomplished her mission, right? Okay, museums are self-reflexive, hooray. So then you got to move on to maybe what's the next struggle. I mean, I got another question for you guys about galleries. Like, it does seem like there must be a lot of galleries. I imagine there's a lot of galleries in China. And is there a non-profit sector, but is there an alternative? Is there a version of an alternative? Like, we don't have anymore so much, but
we call
an alternative sector, which would be artist-run spaces that see themselves precisely as existing in a relationship of tension to the kind of normative mainstream galleries and so on that are kind of anti-commercial or anti-mercantile in some way. Does that exist?
I mean, we've been sort of pegged in that way, I guess, by various media. And they're in Beijing and Shanghai and Guangzhou, in the major cities, there's probably like a couple in each city, something like this.
Yeah.
It's very minor.
It can be counted on one hand, usually.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
It's interesting.
But I think here we don't find artists solely working in this sphere. Like, I mean, artists who don't mind kind of going across the gallery sphere and the artist-run sphere. Like, you can kind of very happy to work with both. Use one for what it's good for,
yes,
and use the other for what that's good for too.
Yes,
but it's not,
yes,
this dogmatic, oh, I'm an artist-run something.
You know. Yes, yes. Yeah. That flexibility, I think, even sort of mainstream and successful artists, they're not necessarily so single-minded about their pursuit of the art with a capital A. I think they're very open and willing to engage in alternative practices, maybe for their own hobbies or interests. Like,
yeah.
So this is a different way of looking at, like, you know, the attitude of the artist. Like, I mean, an artist engaging in commercial kind of, which is exactly what you're talking about, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Opening restaurants.
Yeah.
This is a very valid sort of simultaneous practice along with your art. And so I think that kind of, and I think because of the situation here, all of us working at Home Shop also have to deal with this question of labor and then how we approach our creative practice in very kind of flexible ways. So.
Well, you know, one of the perception, I suppose, in the alternative art sector when I was working in it in the 1980s was, in the U.S., was very mixed. On the one hand, you had people that went into the nonprofit alternative art sector and expended a great deal of uncompensated labor time in the hopes that they would network sufficiently that they could launch themselves into the official art world and have a career. So one of the criticisms of the nonprofit sector was that it served as nothing more than a farm, kind of a farm team, what we call a farm team, that was an incubator for talent, in a kind of a way to triage talent, weed out talent, get people to come in and work for very little money, get the skill set and determine who's actually good, and then you draft them up into the real quote-unquote art world. And then they go, you know, get a job at a gallery in New York, or maybe they get a job at the Museum of Modern Art or a major institution. And some people, so for some people, it's simply a career path. There was nothing particularly oppositional about this. It was simply a way to get your foot in the door. And then other people looked at the nonprofit or alternative art sector and said, no, we manifestly see this as is standing in opposition to the values and the economics of the dominant mainstream, normative art, you know, kind of market-driven art world, career-driven art world. And there were two really different attitudes. And, you know, one kind of took the moral high ground about it, and the other one was much more pragmatic. But it sounds like a lot of this doesn't really translate. Because, you know, your situation is going to be quite different. It's a lot of time has passed. It's a different country, a different culture.
I would say this alternative art scene is really new. So it's still, and each group perhaps is addressed or seen by the art world, the legitimate art world, so to speak, in different ways. So how we all will progress will have to be seen, I guess. But
but what's also been interesting is the majority of the kind of artist-run spaces or alternative art spaces in China have often been opened by foreigners.
Yes, there's a lot of Western-educated foreigners. I think it's simply because a lot of the artists working, local artists, are still coming out of the academies. So there's a very particular angle at which you look at art and your way of making art, and it's not this notion of DIY is also super new in China. So
it's interesting to hear that history in context.
But what he's saying about these alternatives existing in opposition or tension to the mainstream, do you see your space as an oppositional space, or?
If I may.
Go ahead.
I think it's like to be the opposition to the, you know, the value systems of the art world for me. In the context of Beijing and China, I don't think that's a particularly strong stance.
Yeah,
I don't think it is. It's like
because of two things. One, the official is changing and moving so rapidly. If you fix yourself against the official, like the official art world here, it's one moment it's booming and it's doing biennials like this, and then another gallery is coming, and okay, some of that energy has died, but that's actually one of the core traditions here, that the art world is changing so quickly, with the feel of that. Right. So you can't fix yourself against it. And I guess the other one is that there's a lot of space here, so you don't have, you know, the art world doesn't take up in society a huge...
Right, it's a very weak sector, I would say.
So there's a lot of room to be... Also, you know, as Reinhardt says, you know, or whatever, right? To just be alongside it, you know, like, you're not kicking someone else's guts out, because you can just be there.
But do you consider that this so-called, I mean, there's a difference between opposition and marginalization, or being alternative.
Yeah.
But is this alternativeness then for you a deliberate stance? That's the thing.
Oh, yes.
Well, it is, only if you consider the more recent development in China, that basically the colluding between government and creative industries. I mean, if you consider in this context, then I would say the opposition will be meaningful, or alternativeness.
But most of that doesn't happen in China. A lot of that happens at foreign biennials, right? All of that government-backed stuff. It's like all that soft
but,
power.
No,
well, with the creative industries.
Yeah, sorry.
Domestically
supported. Yeah.
Also, too, I mean, the galleries...
But we're not in the creative industries, I hope not.
we're on the edge somehow, I think, also.
Yes.
I mean, just being a funny space in the hutong.
Yeah, okay. Having,
you know?
But at the same time, too, the gallery system is only like 15 or so years old in China.
Yes.
It's really new, and also, like, museums as institutions are still completely lacking in any sense in Beijing, I think. Like, you can still buy an exhibition at the National Art Museum of China.
Yeah.
Like, there's only, I would say in Beijing, there's only really two kind of museum institution spaces, the Cafe Museum and then also the Yulin Center.
Yeah, but and they're, you know, compared with an international organization, they're B-rate institutions, right?
Right, yeah, yeah, exactly.
So
they're what institutions?
B-rate.
Yeah, it's B-rate. Yeah, and so there's also the sense of there's not an established institutional history that
right.
alternative spaces can be working against.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, but,
well, no,
but
no,
I don't
no,
think it's like,
really
you don't need to.
You
yeah,
don't need
it's like,
that.
It's
yeah.
like, oh, yeah. you need to find something to work against. You know? You just go out. I mean, you can.
So I don't know if that's the conversation. I mean, basically, it's kind of characterize our saying that we don't have an obvious target or like a, you know, clear opposition.
Yeah.
You know, if anything, it should be this kind of like half, you know, political, half, you know, traditional, like, academic, art academia, this kind of, I'll say half and half, but the political will be the predominant one if you have to formulate opposition.
And maybe, I mean, this, you know, this alternative lifestyle is charming here, right? Hipster, he's trying to avoid it. You know, but I mean that as a, I don't know necessarily as an art practice, but maybe kind of interesting as an art practice. But it's not just the political anymore. There's a reaction against a really normal middle class. Beijing, China, major city. I mean, I guess that just happens as you have, you, as a middle class emerges, you get a counterculture to it, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, because the diversity of like of tribes or popular culture, so to speak, that happens with the younger people will facilitate somehow this kind of, I don't know, multiplicitous sort of ways of reacting at it. Being subversive or not to the system. So, but,
So guys, I'm gonna need to head off. Okay.
Okay.
If there's any last questions or anything anybody wanted to ask, then that'd be great. But I'll need to kind of. Move along. It's been about, I had about an hour open, so.
Can I ask one last question?
I'd be happy to answer if there's any last couple of questions, though.
Yeah, I have.
It sounds like you have a great conversation amongst yourselves as well. So.
Yes, I kind of.
No, I have one question then. That just came up while we were all talking was this, and I don't know if I can formulate it clearly. But if whether or not you think then this questions of authorship that arise with this sort of heroic maneuvers of particular artists like Alice or Hirschhorn, these guys that you mentioned, and the gallery that sort of holds that up, do you think that that is then detrimental or counter to this sort of collective group activist sort of direction in art making?
No, you know, I think they're just two different ways. Honestly, I think, you know, I don't think it's detrimental in any way. I think it's what is it's probably inevitably the kind of approach that will attract collectors and buyers because it traffics in certain very durable, somewhat romantic ideas that people have about artistic production. I mean, if you think about it, I relate it to the way art from China is perceived in the United States, which is, you know, precisely is the what the frisson comes from the perception of an artist working under the yoke of a kind of totalitarian regime, and their, you know, resistance to that regime being expressed at the level of individual creativity. You know, that's kind of, that's a lot of what drives the fascination, I think. Otherwise, then people would be just as interested in art from South Korea, but they're not, right? That you can find lots of countries where there's interesting art being produced, but I think the particular frisson with China has been a history of repression. It's the same reason people were fascinated by artists from Russia in the 1980s and early 90s. So that's a kind of a heroic, I mean, you know, Ai Weiwei is a great example of that. That's really what gets people's attention. So that, and that's not good or bad, I think it's just in the nature of the presuppositions people have about art and the conventions and so on. And it's a set of conventions that you can work within and do interesting things as well, but I don't see it as posing a, you know, it's not a kind of a Darwinian struggle or something. I think it's just another set of conventions to work within. It will probably tend to be the more successful way to work, you know, in terms of gaining some credibility. Because I think people have a hard time with the idea of multiple authorship.
Yeah.
And not being able to point to who is the heroic creator kind of a thing. It kind of freaks them out sometimes, so... but that's, you know, that's all right. It's just a different thing, but it's not, I don't think it's damaged in any way. In fact, for some artists I talk to, they work precisely as a counterpoint to that heroic image. Maybe if the heroic image didn't exist any longer, they wouldn't feel compelled to work in collaborative ways in the first place. I don't know.
Yeah. I recently attended a lecture. I recently attended a lecture of Steve Kurtz, and he introduced a lot of the work of the Critical Art Ensemble. And I thought about how, I mean, yeah, they're working as a group, so to speak, and probably most of the time not so named. I don't know, but they're also working very much within recognized art circuits. Showing in Documenta or in various kind of reputable venues, but also elsewhere, I think. And I found the work quite effective to a certain degree, but then at the same time, this whole incident with Steve Kurtz and him being kind of somehow the one who's really pushed as the protagonist of all of this, I wonder how that sort of relates, you know, in terms of him being the hero or the one that needs to be named relative to that group, and how that has facilitated their efficacy as a group or within the art world.
That's an excellent question. And you know, and he's a really good example because, you know, God bless Steve Kurtz. I mean, he was the martyr of that group because he's the one that the FBI arrested. So
yes.
that's really, in a way, if he was already seen maybe as one of the more forward figures of CAE after he was arrested, that was it. He was Critical Art Ensemble in a way.
Yeah.
And it's tough. I've seen, there's a group in LA called Ultra Red that's a collective, and it's really hard for these groups when they start to get a certain level of attention and visibility. It's hard. It's like the Beatles, you know, somebody comes forward, you know, it's like, it's John Lennon, right? It's hard. Very hard to not find this desire for somebody to name the leader, right? And I don't know what the solution to that is, really, but that's a great example.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because they talk, I mean, all of their writing is about the faceless, not faceless, but, you know, the kind of the collective energies of the group, and yet Steve is the one you know, and Don Rhine is the person you know from, you know, Ultra Red, and Brett Bloom is the person you know from Temporary Services. It's,
yeah.
You know...
Yeah.
That's often what ends up happening with collective groups like that.
Yeah.
And I think it's something that happens when they plug into the art world in particular, that the art world really needs that reassurance that there's one person who's signing the check, so to speak, a thing.
Funny. Wow. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Grant.
Thank you
guys.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. I was mostly just listening. I was really fascinated by you guys' conversation. So thank you for that opportunity. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Have a great night.
Yeah, have a good night.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.
Take care.
She's in bed. I'll sleep.